Hello and welcome to the Welsh Rugby Podcast. I'm your host, Ben James. I'm here in the rather salubrious settings of the Parkgate Hotel here in Cardiff. And we're joined by none other than former Wales and New Zealand coach, a World Cup winner, and the man known as the Great Redeemer in these parts, Sir Graham Henry. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
A pleasure to be here.
How are you enjoying being back in Wales?
Oh, second home. I've been back many times. This is just another visit. You always think the last one's going to be your last. So I was here after the World Cup for a week catching up with old friends and now back again for a special event.
Indeed, and we can talk a bit about that because this event will go out, this podcast will go out after the event, thankfully. So what is the reason that you are over here enjoying the rain of Cardiff on a day like this?
Oh, I got an invitation to this Wembley 99, 32-31, Wales versus England, Wales 32, England 31. A very special game. And so it's been a game that I'm sure has been viewed by the Welsh many times over the years. And it's great. There's 18 players in that squad going to be at this celebratory dinner or the anniversary, 25th anniversary of that game. So I'm attending that dinner, which I'm looking forward to immensely.
It's remarkable that it's been 25 years, hasn't it? Almost to the day.
We're still alive. Still alive and looking forward to meeting up with the players I haven't seen for a long time, most of them. And got very good memories of that time in Wales.
I mean, as you say, it's been viewed many times. I mean, it's obvious how high that match in particular is held in regard. You know, we had Max Boyce singing at the stadium just before the France game in the Six Nations. And of course, he sang that day. And there was just so many things about that day, wasn't there, in terms of obviously Max Boyce singing beforehand, the game being at Wembley, Scott Gibbs' try, just so many things that came together to make it such a special occasion.
Oh, for sure. I rang Max last time I was here, had a bit of a chat. He got, oh my God, when I rang him, but he was part of that time, you know, and I saw a lot of him during that time. So a special character, special Welshman. But I think Tom Jones was singing in the stadium on that particular night. It was an unreal feeling walking from the dressing shed to the coach's seat. Didn't have boxes in those days. Well, not at Wembley anyway. But it was just an electric feel on the ground. It's very special. Like you look back, I coached 140-something test matches, and you look back on those, and this one is one of the big ones, one of the highlights. And there was a few highlights, but this one was a massive, massive game. And I think a couple of weeks later, we played the French in Paris and had another win by 1 point, which was incredible. So, no, special time and just a special group of young men at the time. They're not young men anymore. So they'll be, you know, in their 50s now and or thereabouts. And so I look back with very fond memories.
You mentioned Max Boyce and Tom Jones. They're singing pre-match. Did you find that you were having to sort of keep the players' attention on the game? Because it was such a spectacle, wasn't it, in terms of, you know, this end of the Five Nations. You know, I think England were denied the title that day.
I think they might have been denied the Grand Slam.
Yeah, it denied the Grand Slam, wasn't it?
Yes.
But with, you know, having legends like Max Boyce and Tom Jones singing, was it a bit of a task to sort of focus the minds? No, not at all.
Well, I didn't think so. Maybe I was away with the fairies myself, but no. The boys were pretty focused. We hadn't had a great Six Nations from memory. Maybe we'd played the Italians in Rome the week before, I think, and had a win then. But I think that was the first win of the Six Nations. I don't know where the Great Redeemer came from. It's a bit of a fallacy. But that we weren't expected to win that game. So that's why it was probably really special as well, because there was the anticipation wasn't that positive going into the game. Like we were going to give our best, no doubt about that. We being the Welsh, we were going to give our best, and our best was good enough.
Because I can't remember who tells the story, if it's Peter Rogers or someone else, but the week before the England game, you trained at St. Helens in Swansea, and I believe you asked the players how many of them had beaten England, and only a few put their hands up, which I suppose demonstrates the task you had ahead of you.
I can't remember that. Possibly that happened. I know I went and saw St. David, the patron saint, all the way to the West Coast. So, you know, that was pretty special, asking him for his support. The things you do when you're under pressure.
But it all paid off, of course, culminating in that incredible try at the end by Scott Gibbs. What are your memories of that? I mean, that try has taken on a life of its own, you know.
Well, I remember Garen Jenkins throwing the ball in. I can remember Chris Wyatt pushing it to Rob Howley. I can remember Rob Howley passing it to Neil Jenkins. I can remember Scott Quinnell was in the back line, so it was a five-man line out. And he passed the ball, and it's probably the first time he's passed the ball in his life. And I remember Scotty Gibbs dancing, and it's the first time he's danced in his life. And he stepped and scored between the corner flag and the goalposts. And Jenks was kicking like a dream. Like probably the best kicker in the world at the time. Probably the best kicker in the world ever.
Yeah.
And he was never going to miss, well.
I'd say that.
Yeah, but he kicked beautifully that day. He kicked some brilliant goals from a long way out to keep us in the game. So at that point, we're only 6 points adrift. And it was probably about 5 or 6 minutes before the end of the game. I can't remember exactly. But there was things that happened in that try-scoring event that you don't see often. Cornell passing, Gibbs stepping, everything was perfect.
Indeed it was. And I mean, do you have memories of the sort of the aftermath of the game, the night that followed, or is that all a bit hazy?
Oh, I'm sure we had a couple of quiet ones and sang a few songs, as the Welsh do. No, there was elation, obviously, and it lifted the nation, because there was quite a bit of unemployment in the valleys. And, you know, winning against England, they tell me it's pretty special. It was very special for that group of people. And the team hadn't been playing that well, hadn't had the results. But it was a pretty experienced side when you look at that group of players. And they went on and, I think, had 11 games on the trot where they won, and some big games: South Africa, England, France, and you know, just to mention three that I can remember. But some big games.
I mean, that's where you said the Great Redeemer tag was a fallacy. I think that 11 game winning run, that was where it was sort of made, as you say, wins over France, South Africa. I think the first British team to win a Test series in Argentina as well.
Yes, yes.
So a lot of milestones hit on that run, and it must have been heading into that sort of that 99 World Cup that the Wales were hosting. It just must have been a remarkable time.
Yes, yes. No, and as I say, you know, there was a group of very talented rugby players, and they gelled well together, and there was a lot of spirit there. It was just great to be involved. Real pleasure.
In terms of beating England, as you say, it means something different to the Welsh, doesn't it? How early did that become maybe apparent when you took the job that
I think
there's 3 million people who want to beat the English?
Yes, well, no doubt about that. And the English wasn't a concern to them, which heightened the rivalry. I could use stronger terms. It was pretty obvious. You know, I'd been living in Wales then for almost a year. I picked up a few vibes on the way about that. But, you know, we played England a few times when I was coach, and I think that was the only win we had. So it was pretty important.
So you mentioned that there was 11 straight victories heading into the World Cup. What, one of the anecdotes I've heard over the years, I think it's from Steve Black, who was behind it, was heading into the 99 World Cup, got the whole squad to imagine lifting the World Cup, an imaginary World Cup at Brecon. Do you have any memories of,
no,
of that?
But Blackie would have those sort of, he'd bring up those sort of things, I'm sure. He was superb, actually. It was a pity the media drove him out of Wales, which was very annoying. But I just thought I'd mention that, Ben. So they were very derogatory. And he was an outstanding individual, an outstanding conditioning coach. He didn't look the part, but he certainly could do the part. And he was a fabulous man. Miss him terribly.
Just how important was he? Because I suppose all the tales you hear about him, they're almost, it's what he did on a human level that was almost more important than what he did in terms of the remit of the job, which I think speaks volumes as to probably what he was like.
And you know, he connected superbly with the guys. They had huge respect for him. Funny enough, when I first arrived in Wales, I had a ring from Pat Lamb. And Pat Lamb's now coaching Bristol, but he was playing for Newcastle then. And Blackie was their conditioning coach. And I knew Pat from Auckland days. I'd coached him for a number of years. And he said, "You need to get hold of Steve Black, Ted." And I said, "Who's Steve Black?" And I rang him. I rang Steve Black. And we arranged to meet in Bristol. He got off the train. I drove to the Bristol station. And we just connected straight away. He was different. But he had a great feel for people, a great love for people, and trying to get the best out of them. And as you say, his connection on the individual level was probably more important than being the strength and conditioning coach with the group.
I suppose, I mean, it's probably always the case in Welsh rugby, but particularly maybe with that squad then, is a lot of talented players, but maybe they needed that belief and that, or someone to believe in them, didn't they, really, to sort of achieve?
Yeah, well, I think we had a management group, David Pickering, who'd Captain Wales, Lynn Howells, help me. And so that was important. We had, and Blackie obviously, but I think all our expectations was that we would win rugby games. And why not? Why not? That was, and we had a talented group of young players, or talented group of players, and some of them were pretty experienced at that stage. So it was just a matter of putting the right team on the field, I think. And so they had some success.
How do you look back on the 99 World Cup then? Because going into that as
a host nation. You know, we got beaten in the quarterfinal by Australia, who went on to win it. And they were pretty good in those days. So we were disappointed. We obviously had higher expectations than that. But I think that in reality, I can't remember the score.
No, I don't know off the top of my head. But
there wasn't a lot in it.
No.
But in reality, they were better than us, which was annoying. But, you know, you look back and think, well, did we do everything we could have? Yeah, maybe we peaked a bit early. Not sure. But we certainly gave it our best shot.
And then, you know, another thing that's obviously remembered from that time is this situation with Shane Howarth and Brett Sinkinson. Just how much of a blow was that? Just all that, the way that came out and that unfolded.
Extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Extremely difficult. Because I had been given the word from the Welsh Rugby Union they were eligible to play. And so I found that extremely difficult at the time. And it was massive headlines in the newspapers all around Great Britain. And there was huge attention, and they were top young men, both very good rugby players. Howarth was always going to be in the side. Brent Simpkinson sort of came from nowhere, really. I knew that he was a Kiwi, and he tells me he had the Welsh ancestry, and that was, you know, the paperwork was dealt with by the union at the time. But, you know, it was a very difficult situation, which got a lot of media attention and created a lot of pressure at the time. But, you know, these things happen, I guess, and you just got to deal with them the best you can.
Did it make your job that much harder to sort of navigate?
It was a massive distraction, as you can appreciate. And so just dealing with that personally was a difficult time.
How do you reflect on your time in Wales overall? So we touched on the England victory that you're here.
Oh, no, I love my time in Wales. My wife and I loved our time in Wales. So she came over a bit later than me. We had a boy still at school. That was in 98. So she came after he finished school. And then she started coaching club netball in Cardiff. And they asked her to coach the Welsh team. So she was coaching the Welsh netball team while I was coaching the rugby side. So we were pretty busy. But it was a great experience, and it got us fully involved in the Welsh community. We went to rugby clubs and netball clubs and schools and all sorts of places, just getting involved in the Welsh community. We had a magnificent time here. Some difficult times, some learning times, but you only learn from those difficult times. And so I look back, and I've been back many times. And I wouldn't be back many times unless I had a very enjoyable experience. So I feel very thankful for the time I spent here. It enabled me to grow as a person. But we also met a lot of people that we enjoyed their company, respected them. And so it was a very good time in our lives.
I suppose moving into the next job, obviously the big job of New Zealand, you probably learned a lot from that experience Wales that you could then apply to that.
Yeah, I don't know how the Welsh boys put up with me, really. Because I was a pretty... my coaching at that stage was... The team was coach-driven, and... So my expectations were massively high, and I put a lot of pressure on them to perform. And it was how I'd been brought up as a rugby player and my rugby experience. So it was a dominating, coach-driven environment. And I've got no excuses for that. I've got no apology for that. It was just part of what you did. But when I left Wales and I'd coached the Lions as well, I thought there must be a better way to bring the best out of these guys. And so I changed. And I changed through the experience of Wales, coaching the Welsh and coaching the British and Irish Lions, to a team-driven environment where you have a group of players and management who drive the team together. And so... I changed from a coach-driven environment to a team-driven environment where I sat at the back of the bus, if you like, rather than the front of the bus, and tried, with other people's help, and I had a very good management team, with other people's help, tried to raise the bar with everybody in the group. And everybody, well, most, just about everybody, bought into that. So it was about personal development, getting better, like the combination of being humble and hungry, humble to know where you were, hungry to keep on improving. So you're constantly lifting your personal contribution to the team, not only as a player, but also as a team member, and how you could inspire others and so on. So massive learning curve for me. And the poor old Welsh guys went through that learning curve while I was going through it, you know. So it was just part of your personal rugby coaching development, I guess. I remember sitting with Clive Woodward and the English coaches after a game at Twickenham, where they'd won reasonably easily. And I think there was Blackie, myself, Lynn Howells was a forward coach. Alan Lewis did a lot of work with the backs. Alan Carter was our technician, who helped us immensely. David Pickering, obviously the manager, but they had about 12 staff and we had about half a dozen. We had less, probably a third of what they had. And he said to me, "Graham, you don't expect you four to beat us 12, do you?" And there was a bit of a learning curve, actually, because I'd been a school teacher. Rugby was my hobby. I'd only finished, I was a headmaster in 1996. And so this was 2 or 3 years later. I've been coaching full-time when I arrived from Wales only for a year and a half. Before that, I was an educator, or I hoped I was an educator. So, no, those guys were particularly special, but there was a message there, you know. And as time went on, more individuals got involved in the coaching. And so you had specialist scrum coach, specialist line-out coach, specialist attack coach, specialist defence coach, etc., etc. And so, you know, you learn from that.
You mentioned the Lions tour. What was that like as an experience? Because I guess that in itself was probably another learning curve in terms of having to juggle that job.
Yeah, no, it was the wrong decision. But, you know, it was the circumstances at the time. I just wanted to stick it up New Zealand rugby because they didn't think I was good enough. So to be asked to coach the Lions was something really special. And I didn't want to turn that down. The Welsh Rugby Union actually said to me, "You've got too much on your plate. You can't be able to handle this." And I thought I was bulletproof, and I wasn't, but I thought I was, which is okay. But that's another learning curve. But no, it was a pretty lonely tour. I was the first non-British Isles person, Irish-British Isles, Irish and the British Lions, the only first non-British person or whatever to coach that team. And so I didn't really know the rest of the management team. And when you're into something like that, it's pretty important to have an association. No disrespect. Very good coaches, enjoyed what they were trying to do. You build a relationship over a period of time with coaches, and we only had a short period of time. And we also had some challenges in the team, some people who spoke out, which didn't help. So that was challenging as well. But it was a magnificent series. You know, 7 tries each. I'm pumping up my own tyres here. 7 tries each, you know, and really was an intercept pass from Johnny Wilkinson going down the blind side from a scrum, and Joe Rolfe intercepted the ball and scored under the goalposts that changed the game in the second test in Melbourne. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you now. You know, that changed that series. Like, both second and third tests were reasonably close. Went down to the wire in the third test. We had a big win in the first test. You know, that tour and the responsibility of the Lions and the Welsh national team just got too much, and I resigned and moved on. So I hit the wall, really. But again, I look back and say, well, that was a massive learning curve. And that quickened up the process, you know, for me to change how I coached. So I took full responsibility, and I had to share that responsibility and share that with others. Still have the ultimate responsibility as head coach, but give other people greater responsibility, both the coaching team and the playing group. So massive learning. Again, difficult tour, but look back on it and think, what a great learning curve. What a great way to learn. Just so happens some people had to put up with me while I learnt. But, you know, that was part of the deal.
I suppose the other thing with Welsh rugby is always the structures and everything with the domestic game, and you'd have had your fair share of that in your time. I think when you'd have come in, it would have been the Rebel season with Cardiff and Swansea playing in England.
I can't remember that. Were they playing in England? I don't think so. I can't remember that anyway. But no, I was part of the change to the four professional teams. It didn't work out the way I hoped it would, but you know, it was a matter of trying to ensure that these players had some success. And the clubs were playing like Pontypridd and Cardiff and Swansea and Bridgend and so on. Were playing England club sides which had much greater resource than we had. So they were constantly getting beaten. So I tried to change that with other people's help. Didn't go down that well with some people. But there's probably too many teams. You know, for the amount of talent, it's probably spread too thinly. And perhaps there should be three or even two. But Scotland got two, have they?
Yeah, Scotland have two, yep.
Yeah. And we probably haven't got the resource to have four professional teams. And so by not having the resource, a lot of players are leaving and playing in England or France or wherever. And not being picked for Wales, I assume. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, if they got less than 25 caps. So it's not as hard and fast as, say, other nations like England and New Zealand, but it's still a really place.
So, yeah, so, you know, it's a difficult one. But we've probably got too many teams.
As you say, it didn't quite maybe go the way you thought it would. Did you at the time maybe anticipate there'd be less teams?
Yeah, less teams. Maybe one in the valleys at Pontypridd. History.
What do you, I mean, I don't know how much you pay attention to what it's like now, but what do you make of it now? Because what we are, is it 20? It's 20 years since the regions came in. This is the 20th season, and well, we're still having these conversations about whether it should be four, whether it should be three, which probably isn't a good indication of what's happened in those 20 years that we're still talking about.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's like I don't know what's going on in Welsh rugby, but there needs to, a solution needs to be found so we develop greater depth. And how do you do that? And they're having the same challenges in New Zealand. So I just think getting good heads together and say, how do we develop good rugby players from our kids? And I don't know what they're doing right now, but it's not working, or it doesn't appear to be working. So that would be my focus. Like three teams or four teams, probably too many teams at the professional level. But the big challenge is developing players that are going to be internationals in the future. In the golden days of Welsh rugby, and I'm sure these are still talked about, the grammar schools did that. And for some reason or other, they did away with the grammar schools. And so all those great little coaches who coached those teams and that development process was lost, which was a real pity. So you've got to re-establish something like that so that we've got young men and women who love the game, who want to play, who are developed well.
I suppose the other thing, as well as maybe the number of teams, is the sort of the competitions they're playing in. There's always talk about Anglo-Welsh sort of competitions, as there has, you know, probably even when you were in Wales, there was talk of that, and it still goes on now. That's, I think, what a lot of Welsh fans would like to see is Anglo-Welsh competitions. But we're also seeing now the suggestion of a Club World Cup, which would, you know, potentially bring, you know, the best of Super Rugby and the New Zealand teams against the European teams. What are your thoughts on that? Because it's one of those things that's been discussed quite a lot in the last few years.
Just getting back to the previous question, Ben. I'm upsetting the interview here.
No, not at all.
Like, you look at Ireland, and they are probably the best development country in the world, meaning they develop their players the best. They probably haven't got a huge player base, and but they've got a group of schools that do that. So there's a lot more private schools, I think, in Ireland, and they are the breeding ground for their international team and their professional sides. And it's impressive, probably the best in the world. So they have got that system. In Wales, we haven't got that system, have we? Because we haven't got those schools. So we don't have the private schools like they have in Ireland. So you need to replace the private schools with something else. What is that? And so that's the big question. So the organisation needs to replace the Irish private school system with something in Wales which is the equivalent. Won't be as easy, but that's the answer to my, in my opinion. Whether the three or four professional teams, that's just a byproduct. It's the development that's important.
But yeah, your thoughts maybe on the Club World Cup? Do you see that as a good thing?
Yeah.
Pitting the two hemispheres?
I think all of those things are good things. I'm concerned about the community game, the amateur game. If we haven't got a good base, we're not going to have a good professional good professionals coming through. So that is the concern to me. Like a world club competition, lovely. Yeah, lovely. But that's just a byproduct of having a good foundation, hopefully. You know, whether that's going to be successful going forward for our countries. We've just got to have kids playing the game who love it. And we've got to provide that environment for them.
What is the community game like in New Zealand, though?
Struggling. Struggling. And you've got a situation where people are not making decisions right now. There's a bit of politicking going on in New Zealand rugby, which is holding up the need for change and providing an environment which is safe, you know, to make the game safer. And I think that's massive. How do we have a safer game where we protect the player, which is enjoyable, so the kids love it and want to be there all the time? And when do we play? Do we play, you know, Wednesday afternoon, Saturday morning? Things have changed. And the economy's not that ripe, not that good. So mum and dad are both working. So it might be that Friday night's games or whatever. But I would like to see some rule changes. Why don't we drop the tackle height to waist and below the waist for the first tackler? Maybe the second tackler can tie up the ball. But if you had a change where you had tackle below the waist, first tackler below the waist, that would free the ball up. We'd have less breakdowns and less injury and a greater game to watch and a more enjoyable game to play. So I think those making those decisions have got a real responsibility to do it right, look after the player, make it safer, but in doing that, have a greater attractive, more attractive game, which the people enjoy playing more simpler, because less tackles, right? Ball available more, ball in play, and a better game to watch.
Because, I mean, I've always been a big fan of one of the things they do in New Zealand, which is they do, rather than age classes in junior rugby, you do weight.
Yeah, well, there's a big Pacifica population in New Zealand. Yeah. Samoan, Tongan, Pacifica population, boys and girls. But So they develop early, big people, and so the little European guy competing is difficult. So they often have different weight levels for the same age, so that all the kids can play. There's an under 85 kilo club competition in New Zealand, national competition, which has become very popular, and a lot of young guys are playing in that, and some of them play till they're reasonably old. Not as old as me, but reasonably old.
I just think it's a great way of, obviously for the younger, for the smaller players, it means they're not sort of up against, you know, facing discrepancies. But then the bigger players, they don't get comfortable playing against these smaller players and not honing their skills. They have to adapt. And I think it was the 2017 Lions Tour. I went to go watch a match, one of the sort of the local clubs around Eden Park.
Oh, yeah.
I just found it so entertaining because it was just such a balanced game. And it's just, I just think it's the sort of thing that we should be bringing in over here, because it's just a great way of leveling the field. And then these young kids have to hone their skills. They can't rely on maybe one trait rather than, you know, over another.
No, it's pretty successful, but as I say, we've got to make this exciting for young people. And what is the recipe for that? Finding the right recipe, changing the laws a bit so it's a more attractive game and a safer game. When do we play? How do we develop the coaches? If you haven't got coaches, you haven't got a game, and so on. So really important decisions to make the game better and to encourage more kids to play again. If you've got a strong base to the pyramid, the professional game will look after itself.
Going back to Wales, obviously, we've had a history of New Zealand coaches after you, obviously Steve and then Warren, Wayne. Starting with Wayne, I suppose, I believe, did he come through at Auckland and under yourself? Did you?
No. Now, when I went back after the Lions and Welsh experience and resigned and went back to New Zealand, after a few months of getting myself right, I got a job as their defence coach. Wayne Pivac and Grant Fox were the Auckland coaches. So this was the end of 2002. And I really enjoyed that experience. The first time that I hadn't been head coach. So it was a bit more relaxing and connected well with the players. And we were successful. We won two national championships on end. And then I was lucky enough to get the All Blacks. So no, good experience with Wayne and Foxy. I also helped Peter Sloan, who was coaching the Blues in 2003. And they also won. So it was good on the CV. Helped to get the All Black job. And a good way to get back into the game after Wales and the Lions experience.
Am I right in thinking also with Wayne, you were perhaps one of his port of calls when he took the Scarlets job? I think you were a sounding board for him in terms of whether he should come to Wales.
I can remember we discussed it. My experiences were very positive. Loved it. And I'm sure he enjoyed it too.
Because he had a great time with the Scarlets, obviously got them competing at the top end of Europe and won the league. And Wales was maybe a slightly more frustrating experience in the sense he didn't get a full World Cup cycle. Obviously won the Six Nations, but then didn't see it through to France. What did you make of his time with Wales?
Oh, look, I was on the other side of the world, so I took a wee bit of an interest. Look, he was a good coach. But the pressures of international rugby and the pressures from the decision makers makes it difficult, I guess. I can't answer the question. I don't know enough about it. Just that my experience with Wayne, he was a good coach, connected well with his players. I think you saw that with the Kalefni. International level, well, you know, greater resource, better development programs, perhaps, than we've got here. So, you know, it's maybe not the head coach's problem, but he has to put up with the result of the lack of development going on underneath. So, and he gets the blame. So and it's a difficult situation. You know, the administrators of the game have got to realise, and I'm sure they do, that the foundation is everything.
I suppose it's a similar situation for Warren Ryan now. Obviously, he's just coming off the back of a first wooden spoon in 21 years for Wales. But again, it's all sort of contextualised by the fact that, you know, all the regions are having to cut money. They're playing kids because they just haven't got the budgets to have sort of bigger squads. It's all indicative of where Welsh rugby is, but nonetheless, it's a big task for Warren, isn't it?
Oh, for sure. And he's proved that he can do the job. Like his success is phenomenal. So he's proved that he can. He's got all the bits and pieces for a top international coach. He's the result of his environment. The environment's not right. Let's get the environment right. We've discussed that many in this interview a number of times, what that is. It may be, you know, if there's shortage of money, maybe lesser teams will help in that regard. And they'll make them more competitive. So there's solutions there. It's just a matter of the leaders making the right decisions, I guess.
I think I've probably taken enough of your time on this trip down memory lane. So we'll leave it there. I'll let you get back to the lovely Cardiff rain.
And, thank you. I have been a bit shocked. I thought the weather was a bit better this time of the year.
I don't know what it is.
It'll be good in the future.
Indeed it will. But yeah, no, it's been
nice, nice to talk to you, Ben.
Pleasure having you on the podcast, Graham.
Okay, cheers, mate.
If you have enjoyed the podcast, do make sure to leave a review. But until the next one, goodbye.